This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
President Biya has his prize because he chose the peaceful resolution of that conflict, and President Obasanjo to the same role.
That's conflict resolution specialist Joseph Vincent Ntunda Mbode in Yaounde explaining awards given to Cameroon's President Paul Biya and Nigeria's President Olusegun Obasanjo for negotiating an end to a long-running land dispute. Details coming up. Also, U.S. President Donald Trump faces new charges, and a new conflict in Ethiopia could spread. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Cameroon is commemorating the 15th anniversary of Nigeria's peaceful handover of the oil-rich Bakassi Peninsula. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde, Cameroon.
Officials in Cameroon say a series of activities to commemorate the anniversary of the handover of the Bakassi Peninsula to Cameroon have taken place in several towns and villages in the region. Nigeria ceded the oil-rich peninsula to Cameroon on August 14, 2008, 6 years after the International Court of Justice ruled the long-disputed area belonged to Cameroon. Aboko Patrick is the mayor of Kombo Abedimo in Bakassi. He says they have organized activities to celebrate 15 years of peace with Nigerians in the four districts that make up Bakassi.
Bakassi conflict is still fresh in our mind, and we do not want a replay of the Bakassi crisis in this peninsula, specifically at Akwa, where the handing over of the Bakassi Peninsula took place, where the Nigerian flag was lowered to hand over Bakassi to Cameroon.
The dispute over the region dates back decades and often erupted into violence. Aboko says since the Nigerian military and administration left Bakassi in 2008, Cameroon's government has built hundreds of public facilities, schools, government offices, markets, hospitals, and roads. But Bakassi residents say Cameroon still needs to do much more to make the estimated 300,000 people of the peninsula feel they are now Cameroonians. Some complain the Cameroon government troops routinely harass people who do not have Cameroon national identity cards and threaten to send civilians who do not pay a bribe to Nigeria. Cameroon troops say they are in the area, which is in the Gulf of Guinea, to protect civilians from harassment by armed gangs. Edonde Cornelius is the mayor of Kombo Itindi in Bakassi. He says despite the military presence, there still are frequent attacks, forcing some residents to flee one village.
A few days ago, armed robbers visited some fishing settlements, and we informed security to keep a watchful eye both day and night. Why we've abandoned Ngoso is because we don't have security.
In Cameroon's capital, Yaounde, there was a ceremony to present awards to Cameroon President Paul Biya and former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo. Joseph Vincent Ntunda Mbode is a conflict resolution specialist at the University of Yaounde. He says the awards recognize Biya and Obasanjo for avoiding war and negotiating an end to the Bakassi dispute.
President Biya has his prize because he chose the peaceful resolution of that conflict, and President Obasanjo to the same road. And if you have peace today, it is the commitment of the two people.
Biya and Obasanjo signed what's known as the Green Tree Agreement on June 12, 2006, and Nigerian troops withdrew from Bakassi on August 14, 2008. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde, Cameroon.
In a rare televised speech Monday, General Abdel Fattah Burhan, the head of Sudan's military, accused the rival Rapid Support Forces, commanded by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, of committing war crimes, despite promising to restore democracy. Amnesty International has accused both warring parties of committing extensive war crimes. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
General Burhan's claims are consistent with reports we've been hearing since the conflict erupted, and in fact, which seem to have escalated in the past months. The Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, is consistently alleged to have targeted civilians. They're using civilians as a shield, which is a potential war crime. They have ethnically targeted communities in the western part of the country in Darfur. And General Dagalo Hemeti, his claims that he is working to restore democracy have absolutely no credibility. In fact, he had very limited trust on the part of the general population prior to this conflict. And now with these systematic attacks on civilians, he has even less support than before. So there's just no way that he can be seen as somehow as a champion for democracy in Sudan.
Amnesty International has accused both warring parties of committing extensive war crimes, including deliberate killings of civilians and mass sexual assault. In its 56-page report, the group said almost all rape cases were blamed on the RSF and its allied Arab militias. Would that report support al-Burhan's position?
Obviously, Burhan is not the best spokesperson, as he himself has repeatedly undercut the democratic transition in Sudan, and his intransigence is partly to blame for the descent into this lawlessness and conflict that we're seeing in Sudan. Moreover, Sudan Armed Forces, which General Burhan commands, have bombed civilian areas, but the sense is that has been primarily aimed at trying to root out the RSF. It hasn't been a wanton targeting of civilians. Therefore, I think it is fair to say that most of these atrocities are being pinned on the RSF, and we shouldn't draw a false equivalence between the two sides, despite the fact that Sudan Armed Forces also have much to account for.
Is there a practical mechanism for accountability for these crimes?
Well, this is the problem of facing a collapsed state where there is lawlessness. And so I think the first and most important thing that can be done is to continue to signal to both sides that they will not be recognized. Even if one side were to prevail, international community, the regional actors need to convey they are not going to be recognized as the sovereign head of state. And therefore, there's not a political end game for this where they come out on top. I think that's really important because reports suggest, especially among Hemeti, that he thinks that he can sustain this conflict and eventually, if he's able to prevail over the Sudan Armed Forces, that the international community will come around and recognize him. So I think he needs to be disabused of that impression and that calculation. I think that can be reinforced with sanctioning individuals and institutions involved in financing this conflict and in getting arms into the conflict. So that's both in Sudan and those who are enabling that from outside. I think it is going to require more engagement on the part of the United Nations, would be critical to enhancing accountability. And I think we need to turn to the ICC. This is exactly what the ICC was created for when prosecutions couldn't take place at the national level. And we should recall that International Criminal Court was active in Sudan during the genocide in Darfur, 20 years ago. And that put an enormous amount of political pressure on the then leader, Omar al-Bashir. And it limited his travel, it limited his credibility, and really painted him into a corner. And I think if that, if Hemeti and members of the RSF and potentially members of the Sudan Armed Forces are alleged, or if there's an arrest warrant put out for them on war crimes, I think it would further isolate them politically and force them to consider other exit strategies.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies here in Washington. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. United Nations agencies are urging an end to what they call a disastrous, senseless war in Sudan and for the perpetrators of war crimes there to be held accountable. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
4 months into the war in Sudan, UN officials say the lives of millions of people have been destroyed and their basic human rights violated. The UN Human Rights Office on Tuesday said it has good reason to believe the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces have committed serious violations of international humanitarian and human rights law. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk blames the rival general's quest for power for the deaths of thousands of people and the destruction of homes, schools, hospitals, and other essential services. His spokesperson, Elizabeth Throssell, says the human rights chief thinks the huge number of people forcibly displaced by the conflict, as well as acts of sexual violence, may amount to war crimes.
Volker Turk expressed grave concerns that the chaotic situation, mired in impunity, is ripe for exploitation by other opportunistic armed actors and militia groups, and the violence may escalate further as a result. Now, while it's difficult to establish an exact number of casualties due to the intensity of the fighting, tentative figures indicate that more than 4,000 people have so far been killed, including hundreds of civilians.
Since fighting erupted April 15th, the UN Refugee Agency reports more than 4.3 million people have been displaced, more than 3.2 million inside Sudan, and over 900,000 as refugees and asylum seekers in neighboring countries. UNHCR spokesperson William Spindler says protection and health teams in Chad, Central African Republic, Egypt, and South Sudan have described horrific ordeals faced by women and girls in Sudan.
Shocking incidents of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and physical violence, have been reported by women and girls who have fled the conflict. These incidents are reportedly perpetrated by fighters, criminals, and smugglers against civilians in Khartoum and other areas, as well as those on the move.
In addition to lasting physical, sexual, reproductive, and mental health consequences, the UNHCR reports some survivors have arrived in neighboring countries pregnant because of rape. The UN Human Rights Office reports it has received credible reports of 32 incidents of sexual violence, including at least 28 cases of rape. It says men in RSF uniforms were connected to at least 19 of these incidents as perpetrators. The agency adds the actual number of cases is likely to be much higher. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump and 18 others have been charged by the Fulton County, Georgia District Attorney in an indictment that accuses Trump and his colleagues of trying to overturn the 2020 presidential election. It is Trump's fourth indictment this year. Georgetown Associate Professor of Government Hans Noel tells VOA's Carol Van Dam this indictment, which includes a total of 41 counts, 13 against Trump, is more expansive than the others.
This is not a, you know, indictment about, you know, misuse of campaign funds or something, as the New York case was. It's not even about sort of suggesting people storm the Capitol where there's a sort of indirect, did he lead it or not, and, you know, did he encourage other people to do something. This is, you know, specifically tampering with the election, conspiring with others to tamper with the election. And there's, you know, there's a recording of him speaking on the phone, saying the things that that are said to be the problem. It also brings in a lot of other people, and so it is sort of connects more to the idea that I think a lot of people have had that, you know, isn't just Trump doing this by himself, but that there's a number of people he is working with that have been sort of acting in concert in this direction. That's what people have been accusing him of, sort of in the press and so forth, for a while, and now it's, you know, in the indictment.
So, you know, it seems to be like in size too, just a lot bigger. I think they said this is 90 pages. In previous indictments, there has been talked of co-conspirators, but they were not named. This time, they're named and they're indicted. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I mean, it says a lot about like the sort of scope of the wrongdoing. It's not, well, you know, Trump stumbled onto something. He said something a little bit inappropriate. One of the defenses that you've heard him say is, well, you know, he believes that this is what happened and it's just about free speech. But it isn't just about him. It's now about a sort of a team of people who are working together with him under his direction, presumably, to commit the crimes that he's accused of. And it's something that loops in all the other parts of the investigation and then presumably means that the prosecution can look at those different connections and use one to find evidence and leverage on another and so forth.
This is the Fulton County, Georgia district attorney. How does that play compared to these other indictments that have gone before?
Right. Well, so in a couple of ways. And first of all, you know, the United States is, you know, a federal system. And so we've got judicial systems at the federal level. That's the case that was brought, the most previous one. And then there's also that there was a federal case being tried in Washington, D.C. Other cases are of that sort. This is the state. And so he doesn't have his position as president doesn't have any particular involvement in what's going on at the state level. So first of all, some question about whether or not the president could pardon himself or anything like that is just, you know, off the table entirely. It also means that the rules are a little bit different. And one notable rule is that federal cases are never televised. Cases in Georgia can be.
And what about this whole thing of bringing forth these charges under the RICO, racketeering criminal enterprise, she calls it? What about all that?
Right. So again, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding of the implication here is that because it's a RICO case, it's a kind of sort of not just, you know, you committed a crime, but you're part of an enterprise that was dedicated to both committing the crimes that you've done and covering them up and conspiring, working with others and everything else. Those laws are usually used to stop, you know, like the mafia.
Yeah,
or
crime bosses.
Crime organizations, drug crime organizations, you know, these kinds of things, cartels, this is what they're targeting for. You know, the idea is that you've got all this activity and what might seem innocuous by itself, when you put it all together and you see what's happening collectively, the purpose of that entire enterprise is to commit crimes. So it's a pretty bold claim.
That's Hans Noel, Associate Professor of Government at Georgetown University and author of the book Political Ideologies and Political Parties in America. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam in Washington. Trump, the leading candidate to win the Republican Party nomination for next year's presidential race, denies all the charges against him and says they are political attacks. The fighting in Ethiopia's Amhara region has now become the country's most serious security crisis since the two-year civil war in Tigray. Amhara is Ethiopia's second most populous region. Residents there accuse the federal government of trying to undermine their region. Dr. Edgar Githua, an international relations security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, who's been closely monitoring the situation, talked to me about the two sides involved in the fighting and what is at stake for Ethiopia and for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed.
Ethiopia has traditionally a very complicated security architecture, where you find quite a number of regions have their own, let's call them militia, who defend those regions. And so in the Amhara region, it's just one of those militias, the Fano militia, who are now feeling they do not want to come under government control. Prime Minister Abiy has decided to bring all these militias under one unified command, but those regions do not want to cede that control. It's a complex problem, but it is almost like, if we look at Sudan, the RSF, before they were the Janjaweed before. So they are a force among themselves. When you now want to bring them into the mainstream army to streamline them, it creates a problem. So that's what's happening in the Amhara region in Ethiopia.
It's so similar in other African countries as well, like you mentioned Sudan. But this Fano thing you just mentioned, it's an informal militia with no publicly known command structure. And, you know, they're not nearly as well equipped or organized as the government. But could they be a serious threat to the government if the struggle gets widespread support?
Yeah, it's true. The biggest danger of such militia groups is not in their strength. It is not in their military might. It's not even in their command structure and their organization. The biggest threat such militia groups pose to the main unified government is the idea that a people can resist government. Once you plant that seed that we can rebel or fight government, you invite other regions in Ethiopia. The Tigrinians are going to rise up again. You know, all other small regions within Ethiopia are going to rise up again. And this, and collectively, they will be, create a problem that could disintegrate Ethiopia. So their strength right now, what Abiy is struggling and fighting against, is to show that his central government is in control. And it's very vital for him to win this fight. Because if he does not contain the Fano forces, he will invite aggression from many other quarters within the country. So it is very important for him to get them under control very quickly. Unfortunately, it's disintegrating. It's moving into, the situation is going, it's becoming more dire and more complicated. But the faster and sooner he's able to bring them into control and up. And for me, if I was Abiy, just giving him advice, I would have allowed them to remain the way they are without interfering with them. Have an informal agreement with them, with their final forces, to tell them, whenever I need you, you can come to, we can work together. But he gives them that semi-autonomy. So long as he tells them, so long as you're under, you're not opposing the government, I will leave you alone. Now that he is disturbing them, he is going, he has to deal with them. If he cannot deal with them, his problem will be not only the Fano forces, the Tigrinians are also going to come up. Other areas are going to start rebelling against him, and that could easily crash and bring down his government.
And lastly, Doctor, the new state of emergency in the Amhara region has now been approved by the parliament. This move, don't you think, will exacerbate the situation instead of actually controlling it?
Of course. Yes, I agree with you. It is going to make the situation worse, definitely, because you are now radicalizing the people, emboldening the people. It is easy for those people to be very vulnerable to propaganda from their own leaders, that you see the central government under Prime Minister Abiy doesn't love us.
That was Dr. Edgar Gitua, an international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He spoke with me from Nairobi. The Barbie movie was pulled from theaters in Algeria this week, almost 1 month after its release there. Online news outlet 24H Alger said the Ministry of Culture and Arts notified cinemas in Algiers, Oran and Constantine to pull the movie. Neither the ministry nor the Algerian Audiovisual Regulatory Authority commented on the reported directive. The move comes after authorities in Kuwait and Lebanon banned the live-action movie based on the American fashion dolls for allegedly threatening conservative values. Some people in Algeria protested the cancellation on social media, posting their complaints along with the hashtag #IAmBarbie. Others denounced it as censorship and bigotry. Barbie contains no overt sexuality or references to LGBTQ rights, but it seems to have drawn fire in some countries because of its flamboyance and broad message of inclusion and gender equality in a region where homosexuality is widely seen as taboo. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, and our engineer, Keila Williams, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.